Welcome for our lecture computer graphics. We had a brief start on Monday by having a short introduction to images. Yeah, how does an image look like? I told you that in our context, for us, an image is just a 2D array of pixel values, and every pixel can be just a single bit maybe that tells us whether the pixel is black or white, or the normal case is that it's an RGB triple describing the color of a pixel. And we were also looking into what I called frame buffer. So that means the frame buffer usually is just the current image we are rendering, and this frame buffer is often displayed in a window. So when we render into that frame buffer, we can directly see the result on a window. And later on, this window can be stored off as a normal image file, or it can just be displayed like in a computer game, for instance. And today now, we want to look into how we can generate such 2D graphics more easily and how that really works in practice. And we will introduce a number of concepts of computer graphics, including that we will have a first look into transformations, that's geometric descriptions, how we can move objects in a scene and translate them and rotate them and stuff like that. Okay, so as I said last time, I told you what we call rendering means that we fill a frame buffer with shapes, with text, with 3D content later on, like in a computer game, when you have a 3D world and an image of the 3D world is generated and rendered into a frame buffer. That's what we call rendering. And in fact, rendering is a kind of sub-discipline of computer graphics, but it's the core of computer graphics, and this is what we will mainly look into in this lecture. And last week, on Monday, I've shown you a simple example, how to render a rectangle, for instance. Yeah, that was very simple. We had a nested loop and filled all pixels from x min to some x max and y min to y max. That was very simple to enumerate all the pixels within a rectangle, at least as long as the rectangle is axis aligned and not rotated. In the exercises, you should look into how to render a circle. That's already a little bit more complicated. You have to think about a simple algorithm to enumerate all the pixels within a circle. The circle is defined by its radius and its center. Another interesting problem that we will look into next week is how to rasterize or how to render a line. So assume we have here our image, and we have two arbitrary points, and now enumerate all the pixels along a line between these two points. This is what we will look into next week. Or how to enumerate all the pixels within a triangle, an arbitrary triangle. How can we find all the pixels within a triangle? This is also what we will look into next week. And here we will look into the algorithms to do that. These algorithms we call rasterization algorithms, because they sort of rasterize different single primitives. And next week we will look into the algorithms, but today we will look into libraries that are available to do that for you. Because, of course, in a computer game, or if people program computer games, they don't start by programming algorithms for rasterizing lines, because that's well understood and there are libraries available that do so. And I will give you a brief overview of these, of such libraries or graphics APIs more general today, because we can introduce interesting concepts and you can quickly then experiment with that. But in fact, these APIs are not the core of this lecture. So you will learn about these APIs a little bit in parallel, but in this lecture we mainly look at the underlying algorithms. So the goal of this lecture is not to teach you different OpenGL and DirectX and WebGL and whatsoever. To teach the algorithms behind that. And yeah, but to learn that, we will look into these graphics APIs. Okay, for the APIs in general, there are two different classes of APIs. The first one are command-based APIs. That means these APIs are libraries that provide methods or functions that do some rendering tasks. Yeah, that, for instance, rasterize a line from a starting point to an endpoint. Yeah, that would be a function, rasterize line, x1, y1, x2, y2, yeah, and then this line, for instance, is rasterized. And to generate your image, yeah, you have several lines and whatever simple primitives, yeah, and you send commands to draw these single primitives using these commands. So that's the first class. The second class are scene graph based APIs. And these are a little bit more abstract. Here the idea is that you define your scene in what we call a scene graph. We will come back to that in a minute. You say my scene is composited of lines at this position and text at this position and circles and rectangles and so forth. You describe that in an abstract manner, and then you give the entire scene graph to that API, and that API then somehow displays that one. Of course, it uses commands then underneath, but it's a more abstract interface, and we will also see that in a minute. For both of these right now, we will look into 2D. Yeah, so we only have 2D lines, 2D triangles, and so forth. But keep in mind, yeah, soon we will go to 3D. So our objects will be 3D objects. We will have 3D coordinates. And we will see how we can bridge that gap from 3D worlds to 2D images. Yeah, also pretty soon in 2 or 3 weeks. And now we can make a little matrix. Yeah, so we have our APIs, we have command-based and scene graph-based APIs, and we have 2D and 3D graphics. And today we will look into the basics of these 2D. Yeah, 3D comes soon. And just to give you an overview, sort of, these are the APIs which we will look into in the exercises. So today I will give you a brief introduction to the canvas object of HTML. Yeah, so that's, you will see in a minute, and also SVG. So this is supported by every browser. Yeah, so it's very simple to use these. And then for 3D, usually more complicated APIs are to be used. So as command-based, we will look into OpenGL, which is a library that you have to use if you want to use GPUs, yeah, because OpenGL provides access to the functionality of a GPU. Yeah, so you can send render commands, which are then very, very, very efficiently at very high speed performed by a GPU. Yeah, that can render millions, many millions, I think even billions of triangles per second. And we will also look into this. And we will also have a brief look at X-Freedom, which is a scene graph-based 3D library. Okay, but today here we are on the site, yeah? And so we will look in two simple APIs for 2D graphics, and as I said, also with that introduce interesting concepts that are used in graphics. And both are, for both we chose elements that are supported by HTML, yeah? So HTML is the language in which web pages are written. I think you know that, and you've already seen how such web pages look like. And if not so, you will have to learn during that lecture, but it's really very, very simple. And there are two special elements on web pages that we will use here. The first one is the canvas element in HTML. This is a simple rectangle on the screen, and you can directly send commands to render into these rectangles. Yeah, so you can program the content by commands, yeah, that draw into that element. So that's a command-based API. And then we look into SVG elements. These are elements that display scene graphs. Yeah, so you define your scene in the form of a scene graph, and the element then displays that scene. Yeah. Okay, but we will start with a canvas element, and so the idea of a canvas element is that in your HTML code, yeah, such an element here can appear. This is how such an element is defined, yeah, and you see it has the type canvas. It has an identifier, which we also chose canvas, and you define the width and the height of that element. Yeah, and now you have a 200 by 200 pixel sized rectangle or square on your screen, and we can directly draw into that. And to draw into that, we need to add code, yeah, JavaScript code. And this code is added with such a script element here, yeah. And within that script element, you can directly provide JavaScript code. So it's really very simple. And in that code, the idea is always that, of course, you have to define into which canvas we want to draw. So there can be multiple canvases on our screen. So to address that, we need that ID. Yeah, and that ID defines automatically a global variable canvas. And this global variable canvas here, yeah, so this must be the same names here. This canvas, we can ask for a 2D context. Yeah, so this is getContext delivers us an object, which is called context. That's a very typical way. We will see that quite often. And this object, to this object that we get here, to this context, yeah, we can now issue commands. So here we get a context object. And via this object, we can now issue our commands. It has good reasons that we don't send our commands directly to Canvas, but go that detour via a context, and yeah, you will get used to that quickly. So, yeah, we ask the Canvas element for such a context. Yeah, so you see here we provide 2D. In fact, there will be other possibilities to get a context, even OpenGL context, yeah, so, but we will come back to that later. For now, we only use such simple 2D contexts. And then we can send commands, yeah, and you see here the commands are, yeah, rather easy to understand, I would say. So clear rect just clears the content of this canvas. Yeah, so in fact, I realized this. So the width is 200 by 200, and here now a larger. Okay, that doesn't really fit. Yeah. So this code here assumes that the width is 512 and the height is 512. Sorry for that. Then obviously we fill a rectangle at position 100, 100 with width 300 and height 300. That's the meaning of that here. And in between we set the style to fill that rectangle. And this here is just the color with which we should fill that. And you see that the color is defined, yeah, as hexadecimal by hexadecimal numbers. And in fact, the two first digits are the red channel, then the green channel, and then the blue channel. So this is 0, 255, 0. So this is green. Do you have a question?
Yeah, are width and height also defined as global variables if they're defined in the header
like? No, but you can ask the canvas for its width and the height. Mm-hmm.
So you could use that in the definition of the rectangle.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, I won't give you a tutorial on this canvas. Yeah. So we will look at the most important concepts, but there are tons of tutorials, yeah, how to draw into such a canvas object. So one link is given here, but if you Google for tutorial HTML canvas, yeah, you will get hundreds of such tutorials. But I would like to show you a simple example. So here we see it including the result. Maybe I better turn off the light. Yeah, so this is a simple example, and probably I will directly switch here. Here to code that I hope. Is it big enough? Can you read it? Yeah? Okay. So this is essentially a very similar code to what we saw before. So we start by getting this context object. It's a little, here I made it a little bit more complicated to make it, it's just an alternative. Yeah. So you see, we ask for the canvas one object. We get the context, and then we send our commands and we clear it. We set color to green and we fill the rectangle. So that's exactly what we've seen before. And if we start that, we get our green rectangle, and now we can experiment. Yeah, we can move the rectangle, for instance, to the right. Yeah, and then it moves to the right. We can play with the style. So, for instance, we could make it blue. Yeah, and make it maybe smaller, just in one dimension, so that we really have a rectangle. Yeah. So, by the way, these web pages where you can play around, we will provide them to you. I'm still looking for a place where we can where we can upload them so that I can give you links. But we will provide this to you so you can play around and just experiment with that. Okay, and of course, we cannot only draw single rectangles, yeah, but we can also render more of them. So let's say we now want to draw a blue one, like this here, a red one, yeah, and then you see on top a red rectangle is drawn, and let's move it a little bit to the left. And down, yeah, and so forth. Okay, obviously it was moving upwards, so you can ask yourself, where's the origin? Okay, good. So this is the principle. Yeah, we will look into the concepts in a minute, in more detail in a minute. Then we have scalable vector graphics, and this is a scene graph based API, and we will also HTML also provides one of these, so that's very, very convenient. We can also in a normal web browser look at such scene graph based graphics, and here now the tag name for these is SVG. SVG stands for scalable vector graphics, and SVG now directly contains a description of our scene, and it uses again HTML to describe that scene. Yeah, so that's really very, very well integrated. So you see, as children of this SVG node, we have, for instance, here a circle and a rectangle. The circle, now here the center and the radius are defined using such attributes CX, CY, and R, and the rectangle, yeah, with attributes X, Y, width, and height. Yeah, and you see, this is not a list of commands, yeah, but it's really an abstract description of the scene we want to display, yeah. And the engine itself now takes care of rendering that and rasterizing that. So there's one more abstraction layer. And again, for SVG, there are numerous tutorials, yeah. So it's very simple to find out if you're interested in how that works. And here we see a simple example. Sorry, this one is pretty small, I think, but we will come back also to that in a minute, and I will show you more example. So this is a simple scene, yeah, where we see here a number of such circle commands, and they have different positions, and they have different attributes fill, which defines the fill color. So one is red, one is green, and one is blue, and then the result looks like this, yeah? I mean, at the result, you don't see whether it was an SVG or a canvas, yeah, but the way it is defined is rather different. Okay, yeah, so these are the two basic types of APIs, command-based and scene graph-based. And all of them share a number of basic notions. Yeah, like for instance, which primitives are provided. So you've seen up to now rectangles and circles, but we will also have lines, maybe text or stuff like that. Yeah, so we will look into that. Which attributes can be assigned to these objects? Yeah, so obviously for a rectangle, it's the color, but for the circle, here you've also seen that the boundary is displayed differently. Yeah, so obviously we can also define the boundary, and we can define the thickness of that boundary, and we can define the color of the boundary. And yeah, in fact, things can become much more complicated. Yeah, so for filling, we cannot use a uniform color, but we can even use gradients, yeah, rainbow colors or patterns, textures, and stuff like that. So that can also become arbitrary complicated. And that will be a larger fraction today. We will have a first look into transformations. How can we position our objects on the canvas? Yeah, there are better ways than just moving the center of a circle, yeah, but to define global transformations that work for entire groups of objects, so then we can even animate, for instance, scenes. Okay, and we start with a canvas element, yeah, because it's maybe easier to understand in the very beginning, but most of these concepts you will see also apply for SVGs. Yeah? So as for the primitives, yeah, I already mentioned, we had rectangles, we saw circles, but there can also be lines, triangles, polygons. Yeah, that's an arbitrary linear shape that is to be filled. Very often we also want to have curves, not straight lines, but curves. In fact, these are usually first transformed to a set of straight lines, yeah, that are so short that you think it's a curve, but in fact it's then still lines. And all these primitives can have attributes like fill color, line boundary width, stipple pattern, and so forth. Yeah, so let's look at a very simple example. Let's say we want to render some lines, and in fact, most of these concepts here, or all of these concepts, in fact, yeah, are unified in many of these libraries by what we call paths. So a path is a sequence of line segments. Yeah, and so here is a very simple example for a path. Yeah, it has three line segments, and this path is defined like we can see here. We begin the path, so we say now a new path starts, and then we have commands like move to and line to. And line, so this path always has a current point, yeah? And with line to, we connect the current point with a new point with a line and set the current point to the new point, yeah? So line to sort of draws a line, and move to just moves the current point, but it doesn't draw a line. So usually we start such a part with move, yeah? So we moved to here, and then we draw lines from here to here, to here, to here. Yeah, so these line to commands then generate these three line segments. And in fact, these line to commands, they don't draw yet, but they just fill that path. Yeah, and with a stroke command, then the current path is finally drawn. Yeah? Okay. Good. So that's for rendering simple line segments, but these paths, yeah, have many more options, and in fact they are, yeah, the basic primitive that can be used to render everything up to text. Because our paths can also have more complicated parts. So for instance, with arc, we can generate, yeah, circles or arcs of circles. Yeah? So this command here generates an arc from a circle centered at 75, 75. The circle has a radius of 50, and the arc goes from 0 degrees to 2 pi. So 0 to 2 pi means the entire arc, so that gives us an entire circle. Yeah, And in fact, I forgot what that true stands for, but I'm sure it has a good reason. Yeah. And then we render a new arc, which is here is the mouth and the two eyes, and as a result we get this face here. Yeah. And that's also a path. Yeah. And the single circles here, in fact, internally they are described as little line segments. Yeah. So when generating that path, this arc command here, yeah, is sort of translated to a number of line two commands. Yeah. So internally we have line segments. So for rendering them in the end, we only need to be able to handle these line segments. But for a user, it looks like a curve, like an arc. And these curves can look more sophisticated. It cannot be only arcs, but it can be, yeah, what we typically in graphics call Bézier curves. If you're interested in that, this is a type of curve we will look into in much detail in the lecture, geometric modeling. These Bézier curves are polynomial curves, and their concept can be very simple described. So in fact, usually we have two types of Bézier curves, quadratic curves or cubic Bézier curves. And the quadratic curves are defined by three points. And you see that the curve then kind of here is fit into this triangle. So it doesn't hit the point in between, but at least here it's tangential and here it's tangential, and then it fits a nice curve here. And for the Bézier curve, sorry, we have four points, yeah, and they are the curve then follows these four points like we see here. Yeah, so it's a very simple way to describe such nice curves, and the paths also support this. Yeah, so we can, with this command, we can now define a quadratic curve too, and it we need a target position and a position for this in-between point. Yeah, and so we can also extend our path not only by lines, but also by such Bézier curves. And for the cubic ones, we don't have here, but for the cubic ones, yeah, to generate that segment, the current position of the path needs to be here, and then we have to provide these three points, and then this entire curve here is added. And this is a very simple example, like this bubble here, yeah, how this can be defined using such curves. And again, we define our path, and then with stroke, this entire thing here is rendered. Okay, and now attributes, yeah? One might say, what is rendering a line? I mean, that's sort of ill-defined, yeah? Because a line is infinitely thin. So if we render that, yeah, we won't see it. In fact, to render a line, we also need to define a width of that line. And in the end, replace that line by sort of a thin rectangle. Yeah, and for rendering then, this rectangle here, in fact, is rendered. And so if we look at these lines, yeah, and you look in that with a magnifying glass, you will realize that probably they're even thicker than one pixel. And to define that, we have to define an attribute for line. And in particular, important is the line width. That's how thick is that line. But we can also define other attributes like color, the ends of the line. So if we replace that line by a rectangle, we can also replace it with a round cap, for instance, and all that stuff. Yeah, we can define lots of attributes also for these lines. And one particular attribute, interesting attribute. So in that example, yeah, you see here now we increase the line width. So the line here is a little bit thicker. And what you also can see here, we can also fill these paths. And for that, we need to set an attribute, how to fill. That's this fill style. In fact, normally that's just a color. Yeah. And then with a command fill, we can also fill the interior of such a path. So you see here we have stroke. With stroke, the outline is drawn. And with fill, the interior is filled. Yeah? This now again, another interesting algorithm behind that. We will also look into that next week. Now probably you can already imagine if we have that, we can define arbitrary paths. We can draw the outline and we can fill. Yeah, if we look at the possible primitives, lines, rectangles, circles, triangles, polygons, curves, yeah, they all can be described using this path concept. And in fact, yeah, that's why for all these commands, yeah, they are all based on paths. Yeah, and with paths, we can render everything. In fact, even text is normally defined as such a path. So every letter is defined as such a path. Yeah, so the letter T, yeah, depending on your style, maybe, yeah, is then defined using such curves. Yeah, so these might be Bézier curves and then lines and so forth, and then this letter is filled, and by this you can draw a T. Of course, if you don't have a very, very powerful computer, yeah, then rendering text like this will take some time. So some of them are pre-rasterized and stored as little images and then rendered directly. But at the very beginning, all these texts were such paths. Yeah, all these letters, or are defined as such paths. Okay, so yeah, we have primitives, which are very often based on this path idea of paths. We have attributes for these images, and now comes another interesting part, and these are transformations. So here in that little example, what we see is that we render a rectangle. That's the green one here in the background, as we saw it before. And now we again render a rectangle in a different color, in this red here. And you see the coordinates are exactly the same, 100, 100, 300, 300. But obviously, the rectangle is not the same, and the reason is that in between here, we applied transformations. So what we did here is we do a translation to the center of the image, then we rotate, and then we translate back. We will just see that in a minute, what that means. These transformations are applied one after the other. Yeah, usually we have to read them. We will also see why we have to read them from back to front. So what happens here is our rectangle is first translated from the center here to the origin. Then it's rotated. The rotation is always around the origin, and then it's translated back to the center. And in fact, that in combination, yeah, if all these transformations are applied, it looks like it's rotated around the center. And yeah, this is now also a very powerful concept, yeah, because from now on, everything we render is rendered in that new coordinate system, yeah, or with that new translations going on. And we will need that very, very often, these translations. And now the interesting question is, yeah, how are these translations, how is that described? How can we do that in a unified manner? And this is where I will give you a first very brief introduction to that, how that works. We will come back to transformations several times, yeah, and we'll extend that more and more, including how perspective works and so forth. But maybe it's already here a very good point to look into how these transformations work. Yeah. So transformations in computer graphics are very important, and for now we only look into simple transformations like translation, rotation, and maybe also scaling. So these belong to a class which we call affine transformations. So these are very simple class of transformations, and we will look into affine transformations today. And such transformations in computer graphics can be used at many, many places, positioning objects in the scene, animating objects, and so forth. Yeah, so there are many places where we need these transformations. And the general idea, or the unifying concept in computer graphics to describe transformations, are matrices. So we will see how we can describe all this with simple matrices, and to be able to do that in a very convenient way, we will use homogeneous coordinates, and we will also look into this briefly. Some of you from other lectures probably already heard about that, but some maybe also not. Okay, so affine transformations. What does that mean? Essentially, is an affine transformation just a change of coordinates? You can define an affine transformation by describing a new coordinate system in the plane. We are always in 2D for now. And that means we define two basis vectors, E1 and E2, and we define an origin of the new coordinate system. Yeah? And now we say all coordinates that we provide are defined with respect to that coordinate system. Yeah? And the standard coordinate system would be that the origin is in 0, 0, E1 is 1, 0, E2 is 0, 1, but we can define now O and E1 and E2 arbitrarily. So that if we have an object like this here, yeah, a path object like this, we can now say, okay, we interpret all these coordinates relative to that coordinate system. So a point with coordinates x, y is mapped to O plus x E1 plus y E2. Yeah? And now with this coordinate system E1, E2, for instance, yeah, by rotating these coordinates, we can rotate the entire object. Or by scaling these coordinates, we can scale the object. Or if they are not perpendicular, we can even skew that object. Yeah? So we have a number of possible operations that we can achieve with this very simple, with that very simple concept. And in fact, we can, of course, write that down mathematically in a cleaner manner. So we can say, yeah, instead of that formula, we describe that or at least that part here, we describe by a matrix multiplication. So we take these two vectors, E1 and E2, put them into a matrix. So this is a 2x2 matrix. Yeah, E1 is a vector and E2 is a vector. We multiply that with x, y. That's our coordinate vector, and we add the origin. Yeah, and if we replace this here by a matrix A, yeah, we have this very simple formula. And if we call this T, yeah, then we have this very simple formula. And this is the general description of affine transformations. Yeah, it's just a point, X. X is a 2D point, by the way. That should also be mentioned here. Yeah, sorry, maybe that's, yeah. So now this is a 2D point, yeah? And this 2D point is just multiplied by a matrix, and then another point is added. Yeah? So the affine transformation is defined by that matrix A and by T. Okay? And in fact, everything we had before here in that example, the translation can be defined by such an affine transformation. The rotation can be described, yeah, with rotated vectors, so A contains rotated basis vectors. And this translation, again, is such an affine transformation, yeah, where A is the identity matrix and this vector becomes the T. Yeah? So we can all describe all these with such affine transformations. And now the good thing is, if we apply multiple of these affine transformations, one after the other, we get another affine transformation. Yeah. So here in this example, yeah, each of these three here is an affine transformation, and we can just concatenate these affine transformations and we get one new affine transformation. Yeah. So if we want to transform such a point here, we don't have to apply this one and then this one and then this one. But we first compute all these transformations, combine them, yeah, and then we apply this one single combined transformation to each of the vertices. Yeah. So independent of how many of these commands we issue, it will all be one single affine transformation in the end. Yeah. And every point is just sent through this single transformation. And now things become a little bit cluttered. If we take two of such affine transformations, yeah, let's say we take affine transformation A1, T1 and apply it to a point X, then we get X prime. And then we put X prime into another affine transformation with A2 and T2, we get X2 prime. So, yeah, if we combine these, yeah, we put this X prime into here and we combine this, we get this new affine transformation, and you see the concatenation, the concatenated matrix is just the product of the two matrices. This is very convenient. But the offset here, the T parameter, this is more complicated. Yeah, this is A2 T1 plus T2. Yeah, so okay, I mean, that's all doable, yeah, but it's not very elegant. And in fact, there's a very simple way to write that down much easier, in a very, very easy way. And writing down things easily using homogeneous coordinates, yeah, that's the way how we can express that much more elegantly. Yeah, homogeneous coordinates do not have the only purpose that we can write down this more elegantly. In fact, we will see many, many more advantages. So this is really just the probably most easy to understand introduction to homogeneous coordinates. But we will see that there are many, many more advantages of them. But this is the first one. And the idea is very simple with homogeneous coordinates. All that we do is that when we have a point, x1, x2, yeah, two coordinates, we add a third coordinate. Yeah, so obviously this at first sight makes things more complicated, but you will see that this gives us much more freedom. We add a third coordinate and we set that third coordinate to 1 for now. Yeah, later on it will be possible to have other values. For now it will always be 1. Okay, yeah, first of all, that sounds like a not so elegant idea. But the nice thing now is, now that we have the one available, yeah, we can now describe such an affine mapping with this matrix here. And you see in that matrix, yeah, because we have a 3D point, now to multiply that with a matrix, we need a 3x3 matrix, yeah, we are one dimension higher. And we can write the original matrix A to the upper left, and the translation, the T, we write at this position. And if we now take this point, x1, x2, 1, and multiply it with that matrix, yeah, with some linear algebra, you will see that exactly this mapping here is described by that. Yeah? So we get the 2D in the two upper components, yeah, we get the affine transform and again a 1 at the bottom. Yeah, so we can take this point and directly apply the next affine matrix, for instance, yeah, because from a 3D homogeneous point, we get another 3D homogeneous point. Yeah? And now things are much simpler because now we only have a matrix multiplication. Yeah? And you will see that this here, yeah, really becomes just X prime prime is second matrix times first matrix times the first point. Yeah? So we can concatenate just by multiplying the matrices. Okay, and the matrices, as I said, always have this very simple shape. Here we have that linear part, yeah, that's the matrix A, and here we have the translation. And if we go back to the introduction of how I introduced affine matrices, we had an origin and two basis vectors, then we can directly see these basis vectors again. Yeah, so the first column here is the first basis vector, this is the second basis vector, and this is the translation. Yeah. So it's very simple to interpret, and the bottom row should always be 0, 0, 1, because that means that if we take an arbitrary point with a homogeneous coordinate 1, the result will always have a 1 here. Yeah, so we put in an homogeneous point, and in the end we get again such a homogeneous point and can then apply the next matrix if we wish. Okay, and now the nice thing is, concatenation or composition of such operations just becomes a multiplication. So in that early example where we had a translation, then a rotation, then a translation, we can describe each of these transformations by a matrix, and then we just multiply these matrices together, and we have the new transformation that does all these steps one after another. And we can combine these very easily by matrix multiplication. So if we transform a point X by a matrix T to TX, and we call that Y, and then we apply a matrix S, so we get SY, which we call Z. The direct step, from X to Z can be achieved by using the matrix ST, just by multiplying S, the matrices S and T together. And also the inversion works that way, because we can just invert the matrix. And in fact, the inversion of such an affine matrix is again an affine matrix, So we can also compute inversions, which we will also need from time to time, So it's very, very simple, and everything becomes a matrix multiplication now. One thing that is maybe confusing, if we multiply or take the multiplied matrix ST, we need to be aware that this means first apply T, then apply S. And this is, I think, rather simple to see. So if we have S times T times X, of course, the T or the X first sees T and then it sees S. First it's multiplied with T and then it's multiplied with S. And due to associativity, of course, this is exactly the same like this. And this means we can first multiply the matrices and then apply the combined one to X instead of first applying T and then applying S, by the way. Okay, is that understandable? Okay. Good. And now we can look into what are typical classes, typical transformations that we want to do. And we already heard about quite a few. A translation, that's very primitive, a very simple operation. But we can also rotate, or we can also scale. Or new cases, we can also make sharings, like this here, where things are moved sideways, like a deck of cards. Or we can make reflections. In this case, this is exactly the same like a rotation by 180 degrees, but there are other examples where reflections might be interesting. All these are affine transformations. And nevertheless, within the class of affine transformations, there are subclasses of transformations that you maybe already heard of. And I will just briefly go through these subclasses because we will also need that from time to time. And in particular in computer graphics, one interesting subclass of affine transformations are so-called rigid transformation. And a rigid transformation is essentially a transformation that doesn't change the shape of an object. So that you can apply to an object which is rigid, which you cannot stretch or bend or something. So if I take, this mobile phone is rigid, to some degree. And what can I do with it? I can translate it, obviously, and I can rotate it, but I cannot scale it, and I cannot share it. At least I shouldn't, So rigid transformations, is what you use if you want to position an object in your scene. You say this object should be at this position and it should be rotated this way. And we will have that very often. And these are transformations that consist of translations and rotations. And the identity, of course, is a special case. Rigid transformations have the property that they preserve distances. Yeah, so two points that have a certain distance have that before and after, yeah, because we don't scale. And then they preserve angles. So right angle also after this transformation is a right angle, obviously. Yeah. Okay, and how can we describe that? A simple way is to say that E1 and E2, yeah, these two vectors in our matrix. So this is our matrix, yeah. These two, this is E1 and this is E2, yeah. These are these basis vectors, and they should be orthonormal. That means they should be perpendicular. Their scalar product should be zero, and each of them should have length 1. That means our new basis just again has orthonormal vectors, yeah, and the length also doesn't change. Now there's one interesting exception, and this is the reflection. If we have that case, yeah, that the fish is reflected like here, then obviously our new basis vectors again are orthonormal, yeah, but now the direction of one of them flipped, and this is not a Richard transformation, yeah, so I cannot reflect my mobile phone without breaking it, yeah, and but nevertheless, yeah, it also fulfills that E1 and E2 are orthonormal, but we can use the determinant of A to differentiate these. So if the determinant is negative, then it's a reflection and not a Richard transformation. Okay, so that was one particular, or maybe in computer graphics, most important subclass. Another one are the similarity transformations, and this is a combination of rigid and isotropic scaling. So now we say we can also scale our object. Yeah, we can rotate and translate, and we can also scale. In computer graphics, that's often very interesting or just necessary, because maybe different objects are defined with different scales. Yeah, one is described in millimeters, another one is described in inches. And then you also have to scale so that they are in the same, that they have the same scale. Yeah. So now it's exactly the same like before, but the only thing that we additionally allow is that we also scale the coordinates using such a factor C. Yeah. This gives us similarity transformations. And then we can extend that by new additional operations where we have non-uniform scaling, yeah, reflections and shearings. So these are all operations, yeah, which you cannot do on real objects without force, yeah, or without maybe breaking them. And these are all affine transformations, but they are not in the class of similarities. But here now we have an additional class. These are linear transformations, and linear transformations are affine transformations without a translation. So linear transformations do not translate, which essentially means the origin is always mapped to the origin. Yeah, that's also another class, but not so important for our purposes. Okay, now let's look at some concrete examples. Yeah, scaling means you have here, for instance, so these images now always show sort of a unit square and how it looks like after the mapping. Yeah. And now let's say this is our unit square, and we apply this matrix here, then we get obviously a scaling by a factor of 1/2. How can we explain that? Yeah, so let's look at the resulting basis vectors, 0.50, so that's this vector. Yeah, if this is 1, 0, then this is 0.50, that's that one. And this basis vector becomes this basis vector, 0.5. Yeah, you can directly read the vectors from here, yeah, and see how the shape will change. Yeah, so these span the new target square. Yeah, and this again, this affine notation for homogeneous coordinates. In the bottom, we have 0.1. This is E1, this is E2, and this is the translation. So this is also linear because we have no translation. And here now we have a non-uniform scaling. So in x direction, we scale by 0.5, and in y direction by 1.5. Yeah. So now the target region is spawned by 0.50, that's this vector, and by 1.50, that's this vector here. Yeah. So this is the matrix that defines this mapping. Okay, and of course, yeah, we will come back to rotation and so forth. Another other interesting operation is sharing. Sharing means that now, yeah, is not rigid, yeah? So our basis vectors now are no longer perpendicular, yeah? And this allows us to skew objects, yeah? Like a deck of cards that you move sideways. And sharing can be, yeah, or kind of standard sharings are usually defined this way, that we say E1 remains E1, but this basis vector, yeah, the upwards basis vector is shared to the side, yeah, and how much it's shared to the side is described by this factor S here. And the resulting matrix now looks like this. So this is a sharing in X direction, but we can also do it like this. Then we have a sharing in Y direction. Yeah, and these are the corresponding coordinates. These are the corresponding matrices, and this is how it looks like. If we share to the right, we get this. And if we share upwards, we get this here. Yeah, and again, we can describe it by these simple matrices. Rotation. Rotation in 2D is very simple. Because we can only have one rotation axis, yeah, the set axis. In 3D, it will be much more complicated. But in 2D, it's very simple. And we can say, okay, let's define a rotation around the origin. You've seen in one of the examples before how we can, yeah, with applying or with concatenating it with translations, we can rotate around arbitrary centers. By combining these, yeah. For now, if we want to rotate around the origin, what we could do is that we say, okay, we want to rotate by some angle alpha. And to do that, we just define a new coordinate system, E1 and E2. Yeah, and this should be rotated by alpha, and then with some simple geometry, you see that this is cosine alpha sine alpha, and E2 is minus sine alpha cosine alpha. Yeah, probably you already did something like this in school. Another way, and this is described here, is that we define a vector A using polar coordinates. That means we define a point A by its distance to the origin and the corresponding angle, alpha. And then if we have that notion, then a rotation is very simple because we just add phi to alpha and then compute B. And then we can determine what B looks like. And in fact, we will come to the end that, yeah, we get exactly the same formula here, of course. Yeah, that would be very surprising. And the resulting matrix looks like this. Yeah, you see here E1 cosine sine, and this here minus sine cosine. Yeah, so rotation can be expressed with this simple matrix. Yeah, here's this image. that I've shown here. It's maybe the more intuitive way. Okay, yeah, and now these matrices are not so have not so nice values anymore, yeah, because we have sine and cosine, but if we rotate by 45 degrees, it's still, because the cosine of 45 degrees is square root 2 halved, and now this rotation by 45 degrees is this matrix, and if we take a rotation by 30 degrees, clockwise, that means in the other direction, for instance, we will get this matrix, yeah, and so forth. Yeah, if we have other angles, then there will be, yeah, float numbers, but that have been computed with sine and cosine. But it's all can all be described by a matrix. Okay, and in the end, reflection can essentially also be seen by a non-uniform scaling, where we in one dimension scale by one and in the other one by a negative value. Yeah, so this gives us a reflection, like in that example. So the x-axis remains and the y-axis is flipped to 0 minus 1 here. Yeah, so we get this result. And this gives us a reflection. And of course, we can reflect also along arbitrary axis, yeah, here around the x-axis. We make a reflection with respect to the y-axis, so x is flipped. And of course, we can make a reflection with an arbitrary axis, for instance, by rotating, then reflecting, and then rotating back, and stuff like that. Yeah? Again, by combination, we can get a lot here. And we can, as I already said, we can compose these operations now. So, for instance, let's say, first of all, we apply such a non-uniform scaling, and then we apply a rotation by 45 degrees. This gives us this here. And if we now multiply these matrices together, we get this matrix, and this matrix now directly maps from here to here. Yeah, so we can combine or concatenate transformations by multiplying these matrices. And this is very convenient, yeah, and I already mentioned that here. Yeah, we can now simply merge these matrices as I've described it here. And there are what we have to consider. Maybe not everybody is aware. Matrix multiplication is not commutative. That means we may not switch. Yeah. Or we may not swap the two. It is a difference whether I first translate and then rotate, or first rotate and then translate. Yeah, that is a difference. So we have to be aware of that. And we have to be aware that the matrices are applied from right to left. So T is first applied and then S, yeah, as I already mentioned. So here an example, yeah. Why this is a difference. So, for instance, if we scale that one and then rotate, we get this here. But if we first rotate by 45 degrees and then scale, we get this here. And obviously, these results are very different. So the order does matter. Okay, and now for the fact that we can multiply such transformations together to get a new one, we can also exploit in another way. Maybe that's a nice example. This is called a decomposition. And one example would be that we want to rotate an object around an arbitrary center, and we've already seen that to achieve that, we can decompose that into a number of transformations that can easily be described, that we can easily quickly write down. And for instance, for the rotation around an arbitrary center, I said we first translate so that the rotation center we want to have is in the origin, then we rotate around the origin, and then we translate back. Yeah, so that would be a decomposition, that we achieve something more complicated by concatenating simple operations. And here is a nice example. For for sharing. And in fact, yeah, this can be described by a singular value decomposition. Let me maybe first show you that example here. So what this example here shows us is that even a rotation, or that we can decompose a rotation by three sharing operations. So if we take that checkerboard and then first share to the left, then share in this direction, and then make another sharing, a third sharing, we get a rotated variant of that here. Yeah, and that's a decomposition of a rotation into three sharing operations. And now you might say, okay, why does that help? The nice thing is, or it's an interesting problem, if you have an image given and you want to rotate that image, that's not a very simple operation. Yeah, you just want to have a rotated version. And this one now only contains operations that can be done very easily on a raster image, because that sharing here just means that you take single lines, yeah, and move them a little bit to the left. You only move within the line. Yeah, you only take values within a line and move them by some amount to the left. Yeah, so from here to here, we quickly get, and we don't have holes in the target image. Yeah, we just get from here to here, and can do that very simple on our raster image. And this is a sharing upwards. Yeah, we can also do that on our raster image. And this is again a sharing in X direction. Yeah. And then we have a copy from this here, a rotated version from that image. And we only did operations on our raster image that can be done rather easily. Yeah. Okay. So that's one simple application, maybe nice example. Yeah. Here you see it's all a simple, it's all these simple operations or these simple sharings, yeah, that simply can be done by copying within a line or a row. Okay, good. Now let's come back to an example so that okay. I forgot that. So maybe let's also look at these examples that we've also seen on the slides. So for the HTML canvas, so here we see the very simple example to define a path. You see we start at 100, 100, and then we draw a line to three other points, and if we execute that, yeah, we get that wonderful, impressive image, and we can extend that, use arcs, then we get something like this. We can add Bezier points and get this. Yeah, and maybe just to have the link to the transformation part, yeah, imagine these paths, they are all defined using coordinates. Yeah, and if I now want to apply a transformation, all that needs to happen is that all these coordinates first go through that current transformation, that's one single matrix, yeah, and this is the position where in the end the object is rendered to, yeah. So we always will have one current transformation, yeah, and all these coordinates we provide to these commands are first sent through that matrix, and this gives us the real target image. And by that, with changing our current transformation, yeah, we will see in a minute, we can change the shape or the position and the size of all these objects. And we can also fill. Yeah, this is what I've shown here now in another color. Okay, and now here for the transformations. Yeah. So this is the example that we've also seen on the slides. So what we do here is that we first render our rectangle, and then here we apply a translation to the this is the center of our image. Then we rotate and then we translate back. And in fact, it's again, it has very good reason, yeah, but you have to read that from back to front. So we first translate by -256 and -256. So it's translated Yeah, so the center of the image is translated to the origin. Then we rotate. Okay, no. Oh. Yeah, the battery is almost off. Then we rotate and then we translate back. Yeah? And then we fill. Oh, okay. And then we again draw this very same rectangle, but now it looks like this. Yeah, and now we can play around. We could, for instance, rotate in the other direction, but for a rectangle that would make a minor difference. Okay. Okay, because it's not exactly in the center, but we could also rotate around a different point. Yeah, let's say we rotate around 100, 100. Yeah, then it looks like this. Now it has been rotated around this point here. Yeah? And maybe we can try another rotation angle. Unfortunately, these angles are always given in radians, which is a little bit inconvenient if you do that as a human. Yeah, so 0.2 is maybe something like 10 degrees or so. Yeah? Okay, and as I said, you have to see it in a way that there's always something like a current transformation. Whenever we apply one of these translate, rotate, or translate commands, then the current matrix or these commands are transformed to a matrix, and this is multiplied with a current matrix. Yeah, so the current matrix accumulates all these transformations. And you can see that because you can directly also set this transformation matrix. So there's a set transform command, and this takes 6 parameters, and these 6 parameters are in fact exactly these 6 coefficients, A, B, C, D, E, F. Yeah? So the first 4 describe that matrix, and E and F the translation. And you can also directly set this transformation matrix. So here we see the same example, but now the matrices are set explicitly. And if we do that, yeah, we can also define a sharing in this example. Yeah, because that matrix that we've set here is a sharing matrix. Yeah, you can see that here the 1 results in a sharing. Okay. Good. Yeah? So this is how we can handle transformations. And as I said, yeah, we will come back to that transformation chapter later. So this is really only the very basic things that we can do. So what we saw now is that in using this canvas of HTML, we can generate a very big class of primitives using these paths. We saw that we can apply different attributes like fill color and so forth. And we saw how we can use transformations to move these objects, to position them on the screen arbitrarily. And this was always command-based. So we always, to render something, we have some code like fill rect stroke path and so forth. Yeah, and then these commands are executed one after the other and they give our final result. And I told you that the other class or way to describe 2D graphics or to get 2D graphics are scene graphs. And there's one HTML element, SVG. We already saw that example that also supports that. And here now the idea is not that we issue commands, but we describe our scene in a rather abstract way, again by a tree or more general, even by a graph. That's why it's called scene graph. And then we have something which we call a render engine. And this takes this graph and displays it somehow. And this is a concept that we will come back also later on. because such render engines and such scene graphs are the basis for every computer game, for every movie that you see. Yeah, here the scenes, the worlds are described in such a rather abstract way, and then a render engine comes. Yeah, like maybe some of you know Unity or okay, I should. Unity is the most most widely used. Okay. So every computer game company, yeah, they have their own render engine, and they are always based on this on such a rather abstract description, and then a render engine is running and displays that on the screen. Okay, but this is a very simple variant for 2D graphics, yeah, for simple charts and stuff like that. Yeah, so a computer game you won't define in this way by circles and rectangles. Yeah, that looks very different. And here we see a simple example, and I will also want to switch to a demo for that. But it uses essentially all the concepts that we've just seen before. Yeah, it is just the number of primitives. Are not only paths, of course paths are also supported, but they are also simpler primitives like circles, rectangles, and stuff like that. And a very simple example here, yeah, we see a circle, you see that position and so forth are defined as attributes, so the center is 200, 200, center X, center Y, the radius is 100, and then we have attributes that describe the color. The stroke width is the line width of the outer boundary, and the entire thing should be filled in red. And if we display that, yeah, or if we, I mean, essentially, this looks like this here, yeah? So in our HTML code, we just have that scene described as part of this SVG element, yeah? So we don't really have to render or something like that. It immediately displays them here. This do it button, here is a kind of trick, yeah, to copy that content into that element. Yeah, so this is how it looks like, and of course we can change color. We can, for instance, say blue. Yeah, we can change the radius, and we can change the stroke width. Yeah, let's exaggerate to 50. Yeah, but it still works. Yeah. Okay, so. And of course, we cannot only take a single one. Yeah, we can take multiple circles, for instance, like this here. Yeah, now we have three circles, center 200, 200, 300, 300, 400, 400. This gives this result. Okay. Now, that would be very simple or too simple that we just can provide a sequence of objects. Yeah. But in fact, we can do even more, and we can generate a hierarchical structure on our objects. And one important part to achieve that are so-called groups. Ah, here something is missing. And such a group, or here we see such a group. This group element here, or this element has just the name G. G stands for group. And yeah, I should maybe also indent here. Like this. So, yeah, it's now a group node that contains these three circles as children. Yeah, now we have, instead of our sequence, we grouped them. You might say, okay, that's not very interesting. But now the interesting part is we can now also assign attributes to that group. And these attributes now are valid for all the children. So in that example, I've set the stroke width here in this group node, and also the stroke color. So these attributes now are valid for all the children, and that means if here I set the stroke width to 15, for instance, yeah, it will change the stroke width for all the children. Yeah. So this is what we will later call hierarchical modeling. We will also come back to that. And this makes many things much easier. Yeah, because we can group objects, yeah, and we can build complex worlds from simple primitives, yeah, from simple primitives, we build a chair, from many chairs, yeah, we build an entire living room and so forth. Yeah, we can hierarchically model our world. And this becomes in particular powerful if we apply transformations. Because what we can do now is the following. To our SVG nodes, here we have a normal circle, and to each of these nodes, we can also add a transform attribute. Yeah, these transform attributes allow us to define a transformation for that object. Yeah, such an affine transformation as we learned before. And now the way we can describe this here is rather convenient. For instance, here we can write transform equals translate 200, 200. That means this circle here is to be translated by 200, 200. That's essentially an alternative to providing the center. You see, we have no parameter for the center here anymore. If the center is not provided, it's assumed to be 0, 0, and instead we translate it by 200, 200, and that circle we translate by 300, 300, and that one by 400, 400, and as a result we get exactly the same. Yeah? Okay. Not a big advantage yet, but we will see again in a minute how that works, why that helps. And in fact, these transformations can be concatenated, and we can provide transformations also in group nodes. And if you provide a transformation in a group node, then it's valid for all the children. Yeah, so if we have multiple objects and we group them, then we can move the entire group on our image, yeah, by just moving the group node. And now here, what we have here is an example. We have again a group node that has a transformation around our three circles, yeah? And this group node now does a translation, then a rotation, and then a translation. You see this transform node, it may not only contain a single transformation, but multiple, and they are automatically then concatenated. So this is a rotation around the center, 256, 256 by 45 degrees, and this is applied via a group node to all the children. And if we apply that now, we get the same as before, but now it's rotated by 45 degrees. Yeah? And now we can rotate the entire thing also by less, only by 30 degrees maybe. Probably we can even do something like adding a scale. Yeah, and so forth. Yeah, and we always apply that to all the children. So that's also very convenient. And now if you look at that, you see why it's also so good that we can so easily concatenate our transformations. Because now each of these circles, yeah, so the red circle has this translation, then this translation here, then this scaling, then this rotation, and then this translation. Yeah, all these transformations are applied, but they are not applied one after the other, but by combining all these to one single matrix, which is then applied to all the points here on the path in the end that defines the circle. And also in SVG, as before, it is also possible to directly define that matrix. Yeah. So internally, everything is translated to such matrices, and we can also directly define such matrices. So this, for example, is a matrix that translates by 200, 200, and this by 300, 300, and this by 400, 400. So if we do that, we get exactly the same as we had before. Yeah? Okay. It's not more convenient, but you see, in the end, everything are such matrices. Okay. Yeah, this is what I've shown you. Yeah. SVG allows us to group nodes, and we can apply transformation or attributes to entire groups, and this helps us to get that hierarchical scene graph or scene model. And in fact, now Yeah, if we look at that, you will see that with these group nodes, we get a tree data structure. We can say we have a scene or a group node, yeah, that is sort of our scene, yeah, and then this can contain more groups, yeah, group one, group two, group three, and each of these groups, this one contains primitive one and primitive two, and maybe this group contains another two groups, four and five, yeah, and these again primitives. So this is a tree-like structure. Yeah, these group nodes generate a hierarchical tree, a scene tree. Now we speak about scene graphs and not about scene trees. Yeah? And I hope you remember the difference between trees and graphs. And in fact, if we speak about graphs here, we don't speak about general graphs, but about directed acyclic graphs. And a DAG can be described rather simple. In the following way, we say a DAG is a graph, a tree, where branches can merge again. So what we can say here is that we have these two groups, for instance, yeah, and they share one common new group with new primitives. Now you might say, okay, why does that make sense? And the reason is very simple. Let's say you want to model this scene here, yeah, this room, this lecture hall, yeah? And of course there are lots of chairs in here, about 100. Yeah? Now probably you don't want to model each of the chairs again and again and again and again, all at slightly different coordinates, yeah? Because they are identical. These are 100, at least, of course they are not 100% identical, but for our purpose they are identical. Yeah, so we have 100 chairs, identical chairs, that are just placed at different positions in our scene. Yeah, if we have such a graph here, what we can do now is that we take this group and give it a certain transformation attribute, yeah, and we give that one another transformation attribute, and then we get this group here. Yeah, now let's say this is our chair. As a result, we have the same chair at two different positions, yeah, because it's visible under two different transformations. So what we get by going from a tree to a graph is what we call instancing. We can take a part of our scene, yeah, and see that part under different transformations at different positions, yeah. So we have our chair only once, yeah, but to position it somewhere, we just here have to add a new group node with a new translation. Yeah, and then we get a copy, yeah, or we get multiple instances of that object under different transformations. And this is, yeah, what you have in every computer game, in every movie. If you see, of course, whatever, a movie with grass, yeah, then of course not every grass blade is modeled individually. Yeah, it's 100 different sorts of grass blades and they are just spread around, yeah, and you will never realize that every 100th looks exactly like the one before, yeah, but it's the only way to be able to handle such complexity. Okay, and I mean a much less complex example I want to show here, and in fact SVG. So this instancing is really something that is mostly used in games or in movies where you have really complex scenes. For SVG or for graphics, for such simple 2D graphics, this is not so important, and thus this defining something like this is a little bit awkward in SVG, but nevertheless I would like to show you how it works. The idea is the following. So what we can do is that we have a defs section, and in this defs section we can define groups with a name, and they are not immediately displayed, yeah, but it's just says, okay, from now on I have here such a simple tree, yeah, and I want to address it under a simple name, like in this example, prim, in the future. And then we build our normal hierarchy. And you see now we have, here we have this use element. And this element just says, now at this position, insert a link to that tree, yeah, that we've defined before under the name prim. So, yeah, and this link here now is used 4 times. And this primitive is a simple rectangle, and now we can add copies, so to say, of that rectangle at different positions, and what we get is this result here. And you see we have a group with green, that's these two, and one with red, that's these two, and they all refer to that rectangle primitive. And we can also apply this here for the scene graph. Here we have exactly the same. And now the nice thing is we can, for instance, change the attributes of our one single object. And you see now it changes everywhere. Yeah. Or we could replace the rectangle with a circle, and then all these would become circles. Yeah. And we still have our hierarchy, so that here, if we set this to blue, yeah, the bottom row becomes blue. Yeah. And we can describe this entire thing like this. We have our SVG object. We have this group with green. We have this group with red. And now these U's are links to this primitive thing. And now you see, because we can use multiple times to the same, yeah, this, now branches come together again. Yeah. And now we have a graph instead of a tree. And yeah, this is really how every scene in computer graphics for whatever application, yeah, this is the concept how these scenes are modeled. And a scene graph API now simply takes such a graph and then somehow renders that. And a command-based API usually also has such a scene graph, but then it traverses that scene graph and sends command that renders that. But normally, as I said, this is hidden in a render engine. And yeah, so you see both of these possibilities. And in the exercises, you will also have opportunity to look into these APIs, make very simple examples. And next week, we will now not look at how to use code from others, yeah, but really to see how rasterization works, how the rasterization of a line works, and how we can rasterize arbitrary polygons, how the algorithms behind that look. And yeah, so see you next week. Thank you.